when you see people who practice any particular tradition of the occult, they're going to be interested in other traditions from as many different cultures and places as they can possibly get their hands on, right? We all have like a very innate curiosity for how other people express divinity and express the occult when you're already pre-configured to be interested in these topics. So yeah, I've studied both the Western and Eastern.
Welcome to the Cosmic Keys Podcast. This is going to be your episode for the week of August 12th, 2019 to August 18th, 2019. On today's show, we have an awesome interview with author Benabel Wen, and we talk all about Taoism, Eastern occultism, and also the Western esoteric tradition that Benabel has merged with her traditional Eastern esoteric practice. So it's a really fun conversation that we're delighted to share with you. But before we get there, we're going to do our intro with our weekly forecast for this week. So last week, we drew the Page of Wands.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased about that.
Same, yeah.
All about kind of that youthful energy towards discovery and even going new places. And I definitely felt it this past week.
I felt it last night a bit.
Oh my gosh. Listeners, guess where me and Dan were last night? We went to a burlesque show. So I have a friend who is a high priestess with the OTO, but she is also a burlesque dancer and merges kind of ritual occult magic with burlesque performance. So we went to see one of her shows last night and I was like really impressed. It was fascinating to see how burlesque merged with kind of like an occult ritual style.
Yeah, totally. And you texted me like, hey, I'm going to my friend's occult burlesque show. Do you want to go? And I was like, at first I was like, I don't think I can pull that tonight. But then, you know, the Page of Wands was like, do it.
Try new things.
Yeah. So I hit the road and drove to the burlesque show and there was fire. There was actual fire in the ritual. There was
a sword swallower.
We put a pretty long Instagram story, and when I got home I looked at this. I'm so squirmish with anything that makes me squirm, and seeing that sword, I had to delete it off the story. I made our story a little bit more tame, but I tagged the performers and the venue and everything, so if you were lucky enough maybe you got a little preview. But this past week was really good astrologically, too, and I think the Page of Wands fit in pretty well with it, and with, you know, all the Leo and Sagittarius fire energy. Like, you know, we call for a good week, and sometimes I'm like, when's it coming? But, like, right, it's like a moment-to-moment thing, like, right when the moon entered Sagittarius with, you know, Leo, the Venus-Jupiter trine had just happened, I was like, oh, like I could feel the good energy. And that was yesterday. And then, you know, I topped it off by going to that burlesque show too. So it was a great week.
Yeah, I think so. So what do we have coming up?
So coming up, we're looking at the week of August 12th to the 18th, 2019. And I think it's important for this week to mention what happened on Sunday. Sunday was a big shift energetically, because we had Jupiter stationing direct in Sagittarius. So Jupiter on Monday and through the beginning of the week is like at a standstill in the sky. And everything from this point forward, Jupiter is going to be moving direct. So it's done with the retrograde. Jupiter was activated last week. So I would imagine at the beginning of this week, you're still going to feel that expansive and optimistic, like Jupiterian vibe happening. Mercury is also now in Leo. So for the beginning, like basically for this whole week, we've got a nice little stellium of planets in Leo. We've got Mercury in Leo, Sun in Leo, Venus in Leo, and Mars in Leo. So that's four of the major personal planets. So once again, we have a very Leo week ahead of us right now. And also Uranus just stationed direct on Sunday too. So Uranus is in early Taurus, going to be starting to slowly move backwards, but he's going to stay in Taurus the whole time. So that's just like the context for the beginning of the week. As we start the week, the moon will be in Capricorn and making its way towards the full moon happening in Aquarius on Thursday. So when we're at the beginning of the week on Monday and Tuesday, you know, the moon's going to be in Capricorn. The moon, that's where your natal moon is, actually. You're Capricornian moon. Very hardworking, very pragmatic. Keeping the shit together of this show when I'm off the rails. But yeah, so Capricorn moon in the beginning of the week. Keep in mind this is moving through meat grinder territory. So the moon will conjunct Saturn, conjunct the South Node, and conjunct Pluto. On Tuesday, the moon will oppose Mercury because Mercury... Well, I guess, yeah, the moon moves into Aquarius on Tuesday and then will oppose Mercury. But yeah, so Monday, moon in Capricorn. Tuesday, moon moves into Aquarius and is traveling to get to its full peak, full moon status by Thursday. But before that happens, Wednesday is a nice and important day. So the sun is going to be totally conjunct with Venus. So when this happens, you know, the sun being yourself, your identity, your ego, your will, your bright shining light is going to blend with the beauty, harmony, and I guess diplomacy and aesthetic lovey-doveyness of Venus. So that's going to be a nice aspect. It's going to be a good personal thing because the sun is your personality. It's your identity. Sun is strong in Leo right now. And when it blends with Venus on Wednesday, you're going to have this like very relational thing happening that's going to be probably pretty delightful. So enjoy that on Wednesday. And it's interesting too, you know, when we have a full moon, that's basically when the sun is opposite the moon. That's their furthest point of cross. So the light of the sun is beaming at the moon in, you know, full force. So when the sun is in Leo, Leo is 6 months away from Aquarius season. It's six signs away in the zodiac. So there's this point of polarity between the sun and the moon. And that's why in Leo season, we have a full moon in Aquarius. So Thursday at 8:29 a.m. Eastern time, that's when we get our Aquarius full moon. And you know, Aquarius is the theme of Aquarius really is it's an air sign. It's a fixed air sign ruled traditionally by Saturn. So Aquarius is like a mixture of the collective and the individual. Aquarian people are very like socially minded people. Mm-hmm. They really care about the collective and they really care about, you know, justice, philanthropy, and equality. But at the same time, there's this thing going on with the uniqueness of the individual. So it's like this, there's lots of, I'm blanking on the word. There's like, it's kind of an enigma with Aquarius because it's like, are you group focused? Are you individually focused? Well, you're kind of both with Aquarius. So when the full moon hits, that's going to be the vibe in the air. So you might be really socially minded, you might be group minded, and you might be like, I want to dye my hair pink today so I stand out. It's kind of that mixture. And I feel like the times are getting more and more Aquarian every day. Like I feel like technology is a big part of Aquarius. The individual and the collective with social media, it's like it's really interesting with that symbolism. But yeah, that's gonna be happening early on Thursday. And keep in mind too, Wednesday the sun was conjunct Venus, so when the sun is opposite moon for our full moon, the moon is also going to be opposite Venus too. So there is something about this full moon that is going to be relationship centric. So when that's happening, keep in mind the themes of Leo, which is like the regal, shining, fixed fire, and the themes of Aquarius, which is the scientific and techno fixed air going on with the moon. So enjoy that on Thursday. Friday, we have an interesting aspect. The Mercury, the planet of communication, is in early Leo now, so that makes a 90-degree square to Uranus. So when Mercury squares Uranus, you know, I think of Uranus as it's a destabilizing planet. And when Mercury is the planet of your mind and communication, when it makes a square to Uranus, it can kind of cause disruption. And so Friday, for all intents and purposes, is kind of Mercury retrograde-ish. And for me, I always notice that Uranus causes like anxiety a little bit. So watch out for the anxious vibe on Friday. We got to keep an eye on what planets are getting hit by Uranus these days. And Friday, Mercury will be hit by that. So pay close attention to that. And this weekend, from, you know, the 16th, 17th, 18th, Moon will be in Pisces post full moon in Aquarius. And this is, you know, anytime the Moon is in Pisces, it's a very psychic vibe, especially on Saturday when, you know, the Moon will go conjunct with Neptune. I always pay attention to my dreams on those weekends or on those days that the Moon is in Pisces, just because Neptune is there and things get nice and fantastical with that. But the last thing for this week's forecast that I want to point out is Sunday, the 18th, Mars leaves Leo and enters practical, pragmatic Virgo. So Mars was doing pretty well in Leo. Mars likes the fire of Leo, but now maybe instead of being focused on, you know, the self and, you know, attention and being on stage the way Leo likes to be, now we're moving into Virgo, where Virgo wants to be organized and work. And Virgo is all about service too. So your Mars energy, which is your action, your drive, is going to be changing focus from, you know, the self, the heart, to Virgo, which is like service, work, organization. It's an earth sign ruled by Mercury. And we're creeping up to Virgo season, which actually starts on the 23rd. So this is like the last week of heavy Leo, and there's going to be very heavy Virgo at the end of the month. So I'm actually excited for that. I love Virgo. And yeah, that's pretty much our week in a nutshell. So pay attention, you know, to the fiery Leo energy, which is going to sort of reach a climax this week. Pay attention to the full moon that's going to be happening in Aquarius opposite Venus. And pay attention on Sunday to that final shift when your Mars energy shifts into the service-oriented Virgo. So yeah, it should be a pretty good week.
Yeah, I'm excited for it.
The only really thing, you know, the only difficult things to pay attention to, I would say, is Friday. Watch out for the Mercury Uranus anxiety, but, you know, just be patient when that happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. So we got the page last week.
Mm-hmm.
So are we ready to see?
And we got the queen the week before.
Oh, yeah. We've been doing a lot of fire energy. Let's see what we get. Okay. Card of the week.
Yeah.
Two of wands. We are still feeling that fire. Feeling the fire. Woo. Two of wands is really similar to the page, honestly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's got this figure and he's holding a globe in his hand. It's basically, I think of this card as the Christopher Columbus card, because he kind of is dressed like I imagined Christopher Columbus would be.
Mm-hmm.
Though he's probably not an asshole like Columbus was. But anyway, so he's got the globe in his hand. He's kind of planning, what is my next adventure? What is my next strategy?
Right.
So he's looking out to the horizon, to the water in the distance. And he's got his two wands. One he's already kind of holding as a walking staff, so he's kind of ready to go. But the other one is latched onto the castle parapet where he is standing. So there's the idea here that we're in the planning stages for something big right now. It hasn't started yet, but this is a great time to think about some of those bigger goals that you might have been avoiding or not really thinking about in a what can I do right now kind of way, and start that planning process. So I feel like it works really well for the astrology too, because we're kind of at the climax of that Leo energy. So we have a lot of like motivation to kind of put our passion to work and think big. And at the same time with Virgo season coming up, that's where we're going to start putting it into action, putting it into work and getting things done. So here, this is really a card to think about those big goals and start planning to make that happen, really believing in them. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, we got this card a few weeks ago.
Yeah, we did.
Maybe like a month ago. It's making me think a lot of Mercury in Leo, because I feel like there's like a Mercury aspect to the planning. Like, as you pointed out before, one of his wands is bolted to the wall, so he's not going anywhere technically. He's just planning. And when your Mercury is in Leo, you might be planning, you know, something in the department of Leo. You might be planning a presentation where you're on center stage. You might be planning a creative project where you're using the creativity of Leo. You might be planning something fire related this week, you know, because now that Mercury is in Leo, it's out of the meat grinder Cancer. It has that like kind of practical planning thing going on, and it's very appropriate. It's still a fire card, and I have my...
Oh, were you holding some...
I pulled them out of my pocket.
What do you got there? He's holding some crystals of some kind.
So the other week on my birthday, Scarlett and I went to our old haunt, which is this occult bookstore, Alchemy Arts. I bought a book. I bought Henry Cornelius Agrippa's 3 books on occult philosophy, which is...
That'll keep you busy for a while.
Oh, I'm very busy with that. It's like a study. It's like a historical like relic. It's this huge, thick book. But knowing that we're in this fire energy this month, I bought some stones as well. So, and I'm not really like crystal-y at all. I mean, I guess I'm
not super either, honestly.
Yeah, I like them as, you know, little tangible physical things, but I'm not like, this stone is gonna align your chakras, man. Like, I'm not like that.
Yeah.
But it's like, hey, it's the color red. I like red. I can hold it and think about fire. So that's really all they are. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'll be opened up more, but I got a piece of red jasper, a piece of tiger's eye, a piece of carnelian, and I forget what this one is. Red something. But
yeah, you were holding those probably while I was shuffling. So maybe some of that...
They were on my person. They were in my pockets. So.
That energy kind of came through. Because it is fun that we... This is our, I think, third wands card that we've gotten in a row.
Mm-hmm.
The queen, then the page, and now the two. So really reflecting that Leo energy.
Yeah, it's interesting too. Like this past week, I was... We're getting into the dog days of summer, which is like kind of get a little bit of anxiety. But I also at the same time love Virgo season. I love.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
Back to school, football season. Yesterday was the first Bears preseason game. And I was kind of like, damn, it's really already that time of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy we got that card. And I remember last time we got that card, I actually did plan a lot of stuff out. And, you know, when you live a chaotic life like I do, there's never enough time for planning, especially with a fire to back it up. So,
yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be good.
Same.
Well, so definitely stay tuned for our interview coming up. It's a really fascinating conversation, and we're so excited to share it with you.
Yep, so stay tuned for our talk with Vannabelle Wen. We'll be right back.
today on the Cosmic Keys podcast, we are going to be chatting with Benabel Wen, who is the author of Holistic Tarot and The Tao of Craft. So thanks so much for being with us this morning. How are you doing today?
Hi, thank you for having me, Dan and Scarlett.
Yeah, we're really excited. I love chatting with other tarot readers, and you are quite a prolific tarot reader. I have your book here, Holistic Tarot, that I picked up a couple weeks ago, and this thing is a tome. It is a brick. It is huge, full of really fun information. So I've been really looking forward to chatting with you today, and it's always wonderful to meet other readers and learn about their methodology and what we usually kind of start with in our discussions. We like to kind of start at the beginning, and I'd love to hear a bit about your childhood and when you kind of started to become interested in some of these esoteric concepts like tarot.
So I grew up in Eastern esoteric traditions. It was something my mother was very into. She's deeply religious. Every aspect of my life was in some way influenced by feng shui, sigil crafting, the basic presumption that magic exists. My maternal grandfather was a traditional Chinese herbalist, and my maternal grandmother was really into sigil crafting as well. So I grew up in that, and a lot of shamanic traditions as well, where they really believed that the dead and the living coexist. And there was a lot of ancestor veneration as well. Growing up in suburban upstate New York, however, I really repudiated that, and I was looking for something that made me feel more assimilated into Western society. But I think at the roots of it, I still had that interest in the esoteric. So funny enough, Western mystery traditions and things like tarot, I decided, oh, this is not cult, and this is very, very different from what I practice, but it's still, that curiosity. So that's why I got into a lot of the sort of Western mystic traditions pretty early on. Tarot came into my life in around junior high. A good friend of mine gifted me with a tarot deck, and that was when, I knew that there was something to it, you know? And so ever since then, tarot has been a part of my life.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I'm wondering, so like what generation of immigrants was your family? Like, were your parents first generation?
Yeah, my mom and dad are first generation. So they're the ones who immigrated to the U.S. And then I was born and raised here in the East Coast.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I've heard before that Taiwan has been more able to retain a lot of traditional Chinese spirituality because it's a bit more isolated. Is that true?
Absolutely. If you're not talking about esotericism just yet, even looking at a lot of the cultural relics. So there's two of the same sort of archaeological museums, one in Beijing and one in Taipei, Beijing's capital of China, Taipei of Taiwan. And I've been to both. The one in Taipei really doesn't have that much. I think the British Museum actually has more. And Taiwan is also very rich in terms of archaeological artifacts from China. I think one of the reasons is because they have that capability to preserve a lot of their culture and history. Now, translating over into religion and mysticism, because of the cultural revolution that ravaged through China, there was a period on the mainland where people wanted to destroy all things old. So anything old, anything antiquated was destroyed. Grimoires were destroyed and burned, and even family books, anything that referred back to your family lineage, basically family trees, they had to be burned. If you kept those, you were considered, it was considered heresy to keep it. Whereas in Taiwan, a lot of people who were wealthy escaping that brought those relics with them to Taiwan. So that's the reason Taiwan was able to preserve a lot of their culture and also their mystery traditions.
That's really neat. I can't imagine the government telling you to burn your family trees and losing that heritage. That would be tough. But it's fascinating that you were exposed to some of these traditions and Eastern mysticism as a child. Were your parents religious at all, or were these just kind of customs and traditions in the family?
They were very religious. In retrospect, I would say they're very religious. Growing up, I guess I just never would have described it as religious. And I think that's a key point, because I notice a lot of practitioners in the West, they're very conscious that what they're doing is a cult. Do you know what I'm talking about? Whereas I never really had that feeling. A lot of the folk traditions, folk magic, felt very ordinary and mundane. It wasn't something that I had a separation line between, well, this is my spiritual practice and this is everyday life. The lines were very blurred throughout my whole life. And it wasn't until I became a young adult that I started processing information in a way where it had to be more compartmentalized. This is personal spirituality, this is religion, and this is the mundane.
So with your family, was there like a name that they gave to these practices? Because I'm thinking, you know, when we usually ask people about their family's religious background, often people sort of put a name to it, like, oh, I was raised, you know, this denomination of Christianity or whatever other religion. Was there like, did they just consider it like customs or anything? Or how did they sort of explain what was going on when they were doing these practices?
So in Eastern traditions, the history is very long. If you talk about the many changes of dynasties throughout the thousands of years of Chinese history, basically the entire country had to adopt the religion of the emperor, right? But it was more superficial. So for example, let's say for the past few generations, my family is very, very Taoist. But while I'm alive, the emperor changes or the dynasty changes, right? So now all of a sudden, the entire country is Buddhist. And so all of the temples that used to be Taoist are sort of just, you know, replaced with Buddhist relics, and now I have to identify as Buddhist. And so there's all sort of this changing back and forth between Taoism and Buddhism over the many different dynasties that at this point it's become quite conflated. So, for example, in Taiwan, the actual, I call it street-level practice, a lot of them identify as Buddhist for a lot of cultural reasons, because Taoism has a lot of negative implications. It's seen as more pagan, more superstitious. It's more for the uneducated classes. And so Buddhism has a more positive connotation to it. So people will identify as Buddhist, but then if you really dismantle what they're practicing and deconstruct it, it's actually Taoist magic. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I studied Japanese Buddhism a bit in college, and I lived in Japan and Korea for a while, and I was always really struck with this fascinating way of life in Japan when it comes to Shinto and Buddhism, because even people who would say they were Buddhist, they still went to the Shinto temples during certain days and still like participated in certain Shinto customs. So it just kind of makes me think of that. I mean, of course, Taoism and Buddhism is a bit different, but that idea that, you know, these kind of more folk traditions, they persist despite whatever the main religion tends to be in the area.
Yeah, what's interesting about Japan also is Shingon Buddhism is a form of esoteric Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And then also Shinto, if you do the kanji and you look at it also in terms of its translation into Chinese, because kanji comes from the Chinese language, the words are shen dao, and the to is dao, which is Taoism.
Yeah, and I don't know as much about Taoism. Is it like similar to Shinto in that it's kind of a more like animist style religion that works with nature and the spirits and of the land? Is that right? Or I know, does it have something to do with like the way, the path? I'm trying to remember back to my like history textbooks back in school, but yeah, unfortunately my knowledge on Taoism is so limited. I'd love to learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it depends on who you ask, but Shinto, if you look at the beliefs and the tenets and principles and the fundamentals of it, it sounds and it feels a lot like Taoism. A lot of it, I mean, there is definitely a connection. You can almost put a different label on top and you wouldn't notice too much difference. The reason for that is because even Taoism itself, China's huge. And so Taoism becomes very regional. How Taoism is practiced and even the pantheon, the deities, divinities, all of these things are very different in northern China versus southern China, or even the middle parts. And so Taoism itself, it's a lot like Hinduism, where we in the West use one word to describe the monolith, but it's actually many, many, many different folk traditions that sort of collectively assemble together and describe as a monolith as Taoism.
Yeah, when my perception of Taoism, like my go-to things that I think of are basically the Tao Te Ching, which I got like a copy of that at some point, and it's really poetic and stuff, but it doesn't really give me a sense of what the everyday practice looks like. But I just remember when I first got a copy of that, I thought it was so profound. Like it's so simplified and so like sort of timeless. And then another thing is the I Ching, which the I Ching is associated with Taoism, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of like my lens that I think of Taoism through. But it's really cool that you're saying that, you know, even in today's sort of materialistic world, your family brought that over to America and incorporated that into your life, you know, just as you're a kid living in upstate New York. That's really cool that that was preserved.
Yeah, and, you know, even the Tao Te Ching and I Ching, I think with these texts, you can read it at different levels. So on one level, it is philosophy, but then on another, if you know what you're looking for, the subtext is actually quite esoteric. So in the Tao Te Ching, one of the interesting principles that I get out of it is that the concept of the left-hand path and the right-hand path in craft is one and the same. One cannot exist without the other. And so the Tao is incorporating both of that, and so you see that very much in terms of how to instruct your esoteric path. A lot of that comes from the Tao Te Ching, and then the I Ching not only is a philosophy, but it's a form of divination. That's actually its origins. An emperor was devising it in prison and used it to predict the fall of one dynasty and the rise of another.
Yeah, with both of those, that's really interesting that you're saying that there's like a left-hand path version of, because I kind of get a sense of that when I read some of the responses to the I Ching. It has like, mm-hmm. it gives you a perception of the yin energy as kind of dark. You know, I mean, it is dark by nature. It's fascinating to hear that perspective. I'm wondering, like, if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more on that, like, left-hand, right-hand path.
Well, I think when we use words like left-hand path and right-hand path, they become constructs that we use more for convenience to describe our intentions behind the work that we do. In terms of yin and yang, it's more, that's a categorization of energies. So, for example, just a very, very simple one, we describe all forms of ghost energy, that sort of the occult energy, that kind of the, what, for example, summoning demons or even summoning nature spirits, that is considered yin. So ghosts and spirits is yin. And one of the things they say is people with a lot of yin energy tend to be closer attuned to that energy beyond the veil. And so another description of yin is femininity or the effeminate. And so that has always been an interesting juxtaposition. Yang energy is, you know, the sun, it's the brightness, it's the light, it's the sharpness, it's also the logic and rationalism. But I think when you look at Taoist philosophy, it does continually instruct that you do need both, and they're one and the same at the end of the road.
And it's fascinating that so much of those ideas translated into tarot as well. It makes me think of when you were talking like the magician and the high priestess. You can kind of look at them as like yin yang energy as well too, two different kind of magical traditions or paths, you can think of it. But also with the feminine and the high priestess, kind of that also the darker, the occult, kind of traveling between the realms kind of idea. So it always amazes me to see how Eastern and Western traditions in a lot of ways have similar concepts. And I don't know if they they originate on their own, or if, you know, it came through trade, or how much was self-originated and how much was kind of passed on through trade. But it is always interesting to see these similarities between these various systems.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, there is a lot of universal principles that run through all of the different traditions, no matter which continent you go to. I think what's interesting is people who who study the occult or who are interested in understanding what's beyond the veil in any culture from any continent and each other better across these different continents and cultures, then they understand their own community. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I think basically a pagan from a Norse tradition and I have more in common than they would have with their own community who are, let's say, of the Abrahamic faiths versus my relations with people from my community. So I think there's something about that. People who are practitioners, no matter what culture you come from, understand each other better, I think.
Was your family unique, or was it sort of like mainstream for the whole culture to be studying these esoteric things, or was your family sort of special for being interested in that study?
Yeah, they would be considered unique. It wasn't something that everyone does. I think it's something that their community would have gone to them and consulted them for access.
So it's got kind of like a generational line thing going with your family then.
Yeah, but what's interesting is, so I had this conversation just recently where in the West, a lot of practitioners like labels, you know, you are from this tradition or you do this or you do that. And in the East, accepting the traditions where you're actually initiated into an actual established Orthodox Taoist tradition, a lot of the folk practitioners, they won't identify as a witch, but rather it's the community that identifies them as the witch. So from their own mouths, they would never say, I'm a shaman or I'm a witch. But people in describing them would say, oh, go to the shaman or go to the witch. And so they would never actually self-identify as a particular practitioner path, but other people around them would.
I really like that approach.
Yeah, that's interesting. It seems like everyone's just calling themselves a witch nowadays. So it's a kind of a different way of doing
right.
it.
Yeah, I don't really call myself anything, but I would be pretty flattered if people were like, oh, go to Dan. He knows what to do.
Yeah.
I'm interested, too. So when you discovered tarot, you said in junior high, did you sort of right off the bat have the intention of like blending the two traditions? Or were you sort of like, I'm totally Western now, like sort of rejecting? Or like, what was your attitude early on?
I don't think I processed it in that way. It was more that I've always been interested in connecting to something beyond, right? And I intuitively, you know, without subconsciously is the better word. I subconsciously knew that the tarot was doing something, right? But I couldn't put my finger on that. I just knew it was doing something. There was something to this that was satiating that curiosity for the unknown. And so that's the reason I was always interested in that, because the Chinese methods for, connecting to the unknown weren't interesting to me at that time in my life. And then it wasn't until a little bit later I realized, you know, they're really not that different from each other. There's just a different set of vocabulary that we're using, but everyone essentially is talking about the same thing. And the deeper you read about tarot texts as well, I mean, both Gerald Gardner and Aleister Crowley talk a lot about Taoism and Eastern traditions. Even Aleister Crowley really likes to integrate the tarot and the I Ching, for example. And he thought that he was the reincarnation of a Taoist alchemist, Ge Xuan. So he talks about that as well. And so I think that they're very close to together, and studying one enriches your practice of the other.
It's making me reflect on, like, I sort of got into the esoteric sort of first off through sort of watered down Eastern stuff, you know, because I was into like sort of the counterculture of the 1960s and the, you know, the Eastern influence on sort of the hippie generation. And for some reason that seemed safe, you know, even though it was really esoteric, it seemed, because it was sort of not of my culture, that it was like, oh, this isn't like bad or dark. But then when I moved towards because I'm a Westerner, I moved towards the Western tradition, I was actually really intimidated and scared because I was raised Christian. And it's just weird how back then when I was a beginner, I was more comfortable like dabbling in Eastern stuff because everything in the East to me seems so like pure and like untampered with, and this occult spooky Western style, I was like so scared to mess with it. But you're making it sound like they're both really kind of the same.
You know, what's interesting is what you described for yourself, mine was the opposite. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of I'm not saying tarot was watered down, but you know what I mean? Like, I saw it as safe almost, or, oh, this isn't really tapping into the same realms that, you know, the traditions my mom is practicing is doing. So this is quote unquote safer. This isn't, you know, as hardcore, you know? And so my experience is the same as yours, but sort of the opposite way, where I gravitated toward Western esoterica because I saw that as something that was, I guess, would you use the word safer or just more palatable at that time, given where you were in your path, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think, and I didn't mean to say watered down. I was just saying like what I was capable of at the time was definitely watered down. It was just like, yeah man, like, yin, the Tao, the way, it's so simple, but it's like I had a very elementary understanding of it.
Yeah, and I'm kind of similar in that way too, Dan, when you were talking about kind of like Eastern traditions. There was something about it just was less intimidating to a certain degree because, and it almost makes me wonder if like when we're children, we grow up with kind of our fears and our nightmares from like the Western culture, our ghosts. But in the East, you know, they got those really scary folklore and ghost stories. So I'm not surprised that you could look at some of those traditions and get pretty spooked out by it. When you look at some of those kind of stories.
You know, that's the right word, less intimidating, because I remember a lot of, you know, growing up, you know, people who were Christian would be like, oh, the tarot is really scary. It's, you know, the devil. But I just never had that preconception. I was like, oh, tarot is less intimidating than, say, you know, casting a circle with the Bagua, the eight trigrams, and summoning demons to ask questions, you know? And so I always felt like tarot was, in that sense, less intimidating. That's actually the best way to phrase it.
So when you finally did discover tarot when you were in junior high, I think you said, did you have a particular deck that you started working with?
The Rider-Waite-Smith. And then I think a little bit later when I was, so I started with the Rider, you know, the yellow box, the 1971 mm-hmm. yellow box.
Yep.
So that was the one that I was learning on. But then, you know, in the beginning, I kept not connecting to it, but everywhere I turned, you know, when I went to psychic fairs and expressed an interest in learning the tarot, they would point me to that deck and say, learn on that deck. And this was before the internet, when you basically went online and Googled everything. So the only access to information I had were either books from the public library or from Barnes & Noble, which was later on in the 90s, or going to these fairs and talking to other people who read tarot. Those were the only places I had any access to information. So what we knew about the tarot, I think, is very different from, you know, what people have access to today. Because, you know, I didn't know there were spreads. There was the Celtic cross. That's the only thing you read with, right? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting too with the Rider-Waite deck. That's the deck that I started with at around the same age probably as you. And I remember thinking, oh, I don't want to work with this deck. These images are like so cheesy. And then I looked around and like, because at the time there were some new decks out there. And like I played around with other decks. And even today I collect, you know, a lot of decks. But I always come back to the Rider-Waite, because the more you learn about tarot, you realize like this imagery isn't cheesy looking. Like there's so much in there. And now I'm like a Rider-Waite obsessive. Like I love Rider-Waite-Smith decks. And it's kind of funny that evolution that occurs that I find with a lot of people where they don't want to start with the Rider-Waite, but then they come around and they like just end up loving it so much.
Oh, yeah, Absolutely. And I think a lot of it has to do with when you're starting off and you're looking at it, you're looking at the superficiality, the superficial aspects of it, of, oh, do I like the artwork or not? And,
yeah.
And you're really looking at it from that perspective. And you're thinking, oh, my intuition can't be harnessed if I don't even love the artwork. I have to love the artwork. I mean, you're looking for Michelangelo or something. I'm not sure. Whereas I think later on, after you've evolved and studied a little bit more, you're looking past that and you're looking at some layer behind the imagery almost.
Yeah, it makes me think of how everybody these days just starts with the wild unknown.
Yeah.
And I'm like not a fan of that style. It has it doesn't have the depth of symbolism, so I don't get that, but that's just my two cents. So when you were kind of dropping a few really interesting tidbits, like, about you, can you explain a little bit more? You kind of hinted at like the demon summoning of Taoism. I'm really curious what that is all about.
Let's see, where would I start with that? That's a very big topic. I don't think I was ever, well, demon summoning was probably the wrong word. It was more the religious belief. I like to use the word religion because it makes people understand that I'm not trying to say that this is an objective truth that everybody has to believe, right? So the sort of perspective on life and the world that I grew up in, you sort of coexisted with all of these different types of energies, nature spirits. Some were more beneficent that you might equate with angelic energies, angelic hierarchies, divas, for example. And then others are darker, malefic energies that we personify into demons. And there are many different names for those demons. One is where they can be archetypal, but then we use a specific name, it harnesses that archetypal energy, and you can sort of control that particular strand of demon. And so the culture I grew up in, to get rid of any form of physiological illness, or when there are issues that you can see and feel in the body or the mind, we believe that that has to do with a demon. Now, I think in psychological terms today, there are a lot of ways to rationalize what we're talking about when we said demons, right? But then a ritualistic process of exorcising that demon, where you first summon to confront it, and then you exorcise or extinguish it, is a way to process and deal with physiological and mental issues. And so that was something that I grew up with, and that was part of the culture. One of the things that people would go to my mom and grandmother about was when they were experiencing malefic influences in their life. And what they would do is identify the name of that demon and help them confront and extinguish it.
Wow, it's so similar, where you have to kind of like know the name of the demon.
Right.
That's interesting. You know, another thing, I watched one of your YouTube videos where you were talking about your ritual tools for Taoist magic. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear a little bit about some of those tools that you use as part of that magical practice, because some of that stuff I hadn't seen before, and I thought it was really fascinating.
Oh, there's so many, and it depends on, I mean, it almost becomes a joke, right? Because it can get really expensive, and it depends on, you know, how into it you are. Some people believe that, you know, this particular bell has to be, the bronze has to come from this place, and it has to, you know, even the astrology matters on when it was sourced and who carved it, when did they carve it, what's the birthday, what's the birth chart of the person who carved your freaking, you know, ceremonial bells. And so you can get to that level of things, or you can get like, oh, I just bought it on Amazon. I mean, like, you know what I mean? I don't want to say one is better than the other. There's a real spectrum to how people approach ritual tools. I like to be somewhere in the middle, where a lot of it I try to make myself, you know, and if I can't make it myself, like I can't make my own bells, then, you know, I access it wherever I can based on the affordability, but then I'll consecrate and charge and do things like that to it. Some of the tools, divination moon blocks, where you have these two red moon blocks. What I always say, they actually remind me a lot of the, I don't know how to, like the Umum and Thurum, you know, Bible, and it's also the iconography is found throughout at least the Rider-Waite-Smith tarot deck as well. But that concept of having something that's a positive and a negative, and you use it to do divination, there's two little blocks to do divination. That's a huge part of ceremony in the East, where you have to consult during, after, you know, like you want to constantly have an open line of communication with divinity through any of the work that you're doing.
So with the blocks, do you throw them as you like are considering a question, and how they land indicates if it's the positive or negative?
Yes. And mm-hmm. So you would ask your question, and you would toss it, and then it, you know, if it lands one way, it means yes. If it lands another way, it means no. And then there's one way where they're both, where the flat side is up and they kind of shake. So when they shake, we call that laughing gods. And that it's kind of like a maybe, but what we interpret it as is the gods are laughing at you and not answering the question directly.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah.
So I'm hearing a lot of similarities between the Western tradition and what you're describing, like with exorcism. It sounds very similar to, you know, Catholic and before, and whatever came before Catholic tradition of exorcising spirits and stuff. And then the tools, consecration, I mean, all of that is like in the Western grimoires and stuff like that too. I'm wondering, you kind of hinted that there is this cosmology of like devas and spirits and nature spirits and then like malevolent demons and stuff. Do you or your family or your tradition have like a patron spirit that you directly work with, or do you sort of do it where you build a relationship with a certain deity or deva or whatever?
Either or. So there are Orthodox traditions that are very regimented lineages that you would initiate into. And those, once you initiate into, there's a roster of divinities that you would work with. And it's almost kind of like a hierarchy that you would learn, where you have, like you said, a patron divinity or patron divinities, and then you have maybe another hierarchy of gods and goddesses or certain types of spirits that are somewhere between nature spirit and god status, you know, where you would work with those for very specific purposes. And then there would be ways that you learn how to communicate with the nature spirits in any particular region that you're a part of. So I grew up when I was really, really little without knowing anything. So, for example, when I was small and I was afraid of the dark, my mom would tell me to recite the name of the Amitabha Buddha and Kuan Yin, which sounds Buddhist, but the practice of it, what she was telling me to do, is more Taoist magic than Buddhism, because it wasn't about achieving nirvana. It was more about using these to draw in some kind of a beneficent protection orb around me to protect me. And so when I was a kid, it was more about, oh, just making sure I'm not afraid of the dark. And then it was little things like, oh, if you're scared of, you know, a final exam, as you're walking to the final exam, you recite these mantras. And even though that sounds silly, what she was doing was building up my connection to these divinities through mantra recitations throughout my entire life. For every little thing, if I'm scared of walking down the street by myself, I would recite the mantras. And then eventually it became, when I'm about to get into ritual, I would recite the mantras. You see what I'm saying? So it starts somewhere silly and mundane, but as you grow up, you realize the more profound implications of what you're doing. And so I have a stronger connection to certain divinities because it was something that was, you know, indoctrinated into me almost from a very young age.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Catholicism with the saints. Like, when I was raised Catholic, mm-hmm. and I remember if you would lose something, you would say a prayer to Saint Anthony, or, like, there's all these different sort of saints that are just out there floating around, like, just helping you out. And it's like, Catholics, in a way, in comparison to, like, Protestants or evangelicals, like, at least traditional Catholics, you know, you're sort of just asking for help, and whoever wants to help you or answers the most, you'll give the most attention. And it's not really like God or Jesus. It's like this myriad of like virgins or like baby Jesuses or like all these like characters.
Yeah. It is a lot like that. And I think as I've evolved, my understanding has been more, so Taoism tends to be more pantheistic. And so we don't have this dividing line between monotheism and polytheism. I think of the God, the Godhead, and the world as, you know, sort of the same, where it's a network of networks, kind of like the internet, where polytheism are all of the networks, and then how all of these separate networks and subnetworks connect to each other, and the spiritual component to, you know, the soul component to the physical world, when it's all connected together as a cohesive oneness, that would be monotheism. So we still believe in a monotheistic concept of spirit, but then we are working specifically with the little, you know, separate faces of that spirit and separate pieces and directions of the spirit at any given time. So that would be the polytheism. And so I think of these mantra recitations not as saying, oh, this God that's, you know, living in the sky is going to come down and help me find my keys. I see it actually more as a practice of invocation, where I'm learning to tap into like a higher self, in a way, like a higher part of my own powers and abilities, so that I can bring that into my current life. And so I've always seen it more as an invocation to basically give me superpowers, but that's a funny way of putting it. You know what I mean? It's to tap into a higher, more capable part of who I am, because that part of me is connected to divinity. So it's about tapping into the side of me that has always been divine.
Yeah, I feel like I have a...
I hope I'm making sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I think I have a pretty similar worldview at that when it comes to divinity. I also really like how you mentioned it's kind of like an internet. And I was thinking, like, so if God is like the internet, and then we're all just like different Wi-Fi channels, like all the different religions tapping in, you know, connecting.
So it's like, it makes me think of blockchain, actually.
Blockchain?
The blockchain is like one big entity with lots of little nodes.
I like that idea. But yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And I feel like a lot of the esoteric traditions are about like teaching ourselves how to tap into our own sense of divinity. And really even like divination methods like tarot are just tools to help with that process as well. Connecting back in with the divine part of ourself that's always been there and that often we ignore in our day-to-day life. So yeah, I totally agree with kind of that worldview and that perspective on, you know, the beyond, I guess you could say. I was curious too, when you started kind of combining your interest in tarot, were you also interested in other kind of Western esoteric ideas? Like, did you study like the Western grimoires too, or were you more just kind of like bringing in tarot and adding it to your more Taoist Eastern tradition?
Oh, no, I definitely was interested in studying Western grimoires as well. I mean, I do a lot of that, a lot of tutorials and sort of sharing my research and findings on my various channels and work. So I'm interested in understanding sort of the evolution of occult thought in the West and also in the East. And so anything that I have access to, I mean, I think when you see people who practice any particular tradition of the occult, they're going to be interested in other traditions from as many different cultures and places as they can possibly get their hands on, right? We all have like a very innate curiosity for how other people express divinity and express the occult when you're already pre-configured to be interested in these topics. So yeah, I've studied both the Western and Eastern.
Yeah, definitely. There's something about people who are into these ideas where they just have this insatiable curiosity. And that in a way kind of connects us, just kind of the desire to learn the truth from wherever we might find it. You know, I was thinking too, we interviewed someone a couple weeks ago, and she was a astrologer who also like added on feng shui principles to her astrology. And so it seems like more and more we're meeting people lately that are doing a great job of combining the Eastern and the Western esoteric traditions. So I find that really exciting. And it's definitely inspiring me to start doing some more research on those Eastern ideas.
Yeah, Eastern astrology and Western astrology have so much more in common than people realize. There's the sacred seven, right? And then there's a lot of the basis in space-time on the equinoxes and the solstices, and that's a huge part of how everything else is governed. There's the concept of 12 signs, and even how they describe the attributions and correspondences for the sacred seven is very similar across both Eastern and Western astrology. And so, and also in feng shui, from the beginning, it has always been important and integral to know Eastern astrology in order to practice feng shui. So adding a form of Western astrology in feng shui makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, definitely. I was curious too, when you were, you know, talking about your childhood and starting to learn about these concepts and these ideas in your family, did you have any particular like paranormal experiences, or did anything strange happen that helped lead you down this path perhaps? Or was it just kind of your personality that you think just kind of drew you towards studying the esoteric arts?
Yeah, for sure. There's been a lot. Where do I begin? I think one of it is that we never really had a clear demarcation between the living and the dead. And so there has always been a strong sense of people who have gone on still being present in our lives. And so I've always had interactions with people that I didn't realize till much later were dead. And then, this is not something that people do. You don't have conversations with the dead. And so that has always been sort of part of my upbringing. But again, I never saw it as paranormal. So I think a lot of times when people ask me this specific question, have you ever had any paranormal experiences? I was, oh, no, not really. But then I go, oh, but I talk to the dead and I do this and I do that. And I've always had, you know, a sense of strong communion with an angelic hierarchy or a caste of divinities or spirits of some kind, or being able to feel the nature spirits anywhere that you go, and feeling a strong sense of like animism, where trees and plant life and have some kind of other consciousness to them, and tapping into that, being able to communicate with that. I never saw that as paranormal, but that has always been part of my life, and that it's, I've been governed by a curiosity for what that is and how to express that in terms that people who didn't grow up with that might be able to understand.
I'm really curious culturally how in your tradition and like your family's tradition, how nature spirits are described. Like, do you see parallels between like the Western idea of like a fairy? Is there a crossover between the Eastern and the Western perception of those?
Yeah, for sure. And also, the kami spirits in Shinto, I think we all, you know how one of the things that has really helped me understand how people process information is being a lawyer, where if you take depositions of five people who witnessed the same exact thing that happened, the same exact event, they were there at the same exact time, even from the same angle, you will have five different depositions. It's like the most hilarious thing ever, where one person like, oh, the car was red, and another person will say the car was blue, and they were both there on the same exact, you're like, what, why? And so you really start to understand that people see the same thing but come away with very different perceptions. And that's the same in this case as well, where I think we all experience that there's something like nature spirits, or there's something there, but five people witnessing the same concept will come away with accounts, you know, or depositions of what they're looking at and what they're experiencing. And so I think that's what it is. And that's where the different traditions or expressions of nature come from.
So do you in the Eastern tradition, I'm just wondering how you interact with nature spirits, because even from my point of view, when I connect with nature, like, I don't know if it's smart to have a relationships with those kinds of spirits, because it's like, I get that some of them might have like a trickster quality or like a disruptive quality. Mm-hmm. And even like, you think of like the lore of keeping like a horseshoe over your door to keep the fairies out, because they are just gonna like mess stuff up. I'm wondering, like, do you try to cultivate a relationship, or is it more like boundary driven?
Everybody is going to be different, and everybody will have an approach that works for them where they draw boundary lines. And so I don't ever want to say how people. There is a very good rational explanation for anybody's decision, right? For me, I don't draw boundaries. And so, for example, and that's not necessarily a Chinese tradition. I think the Chinese, even my parents will say, oh, you need to keep away all forms of spirit energies in your house. You don't want to cohabit with specific types of nature spirits, you know what I'm saying? And so, you know, you want to be able to sort of ward your home in certain ways. And I've never been that interested in having those types of boundaries, but that's almost more of a personal decision. So that's not a tradition-specific thing. And I think even within any culture, you're going to have very different views on that. I don't like to draw boundaries, and I find that when you approach this with a fearlessness and a sense of open-mindedness, and you're different from me, you're foreign, you know, in terms of your fundamental, you know, nature. So I have to draw this boundary between you and me. I think you're causing more problems than you're solving, because everybody wants to cross boundaries. Everybody wants to sort of, you know, poke the fire. And so I think when you approach these things with a fearlessness and open arms, there's less risk, I think, of trickster energies wanting to direct that energy toward you because they see you as friendly. But that's my approach.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and I guess I hadn't really thought about it too much before, but there is such an interesting dichotomy when you think of, like, boundaries, and I was thinking specifically of people's homes. You know, on the one hand, you're, like, might have talismans or things like that to keep the bad spirits out, but at the same time, certain cultures, I was thinking of, like, the Domovi spirit in Slavic folklore, where you have your little house spirit and it helps take care of the house, you know, and a lot of traditions have particular house spirits that they're trying to welcome in. So it's almost like trying to keep out some, but keeping the good ones in. So there's kind of that neat tension in a way between how we interact with spirits in our spaces.
Yeah, for sure. Like in Chinese, a similar thing is the fox spirit. A lot of homes, you have this in Japan and China, where a fox spirit is considered friendly in terms of a protective house guardian. But at the same time, in and of itself, the fox spirit has always been seen as conniving, a trickster energy, something to be very, very wary of. So it's like, what? That doesn't make any sense. But yet both are truths in the terms of people's perceptions.
Yeah. Another thing that I really enjoy in my trips to Japan that I've done before and learning about Shinto is with their kami spirits and how they, you know, they'll designate certain trees or stones with this kind of rope belt around it. So everyone knows that, like, this is a sacred tree. This tree houses a nature spirit. And I always, like, come back to America wishing, like, gosh, I wish we did a little bit of that here. We have so many amazing natural wonders in our world, and if we had a bit more, if we revered them a little bit more or had a little bit more spiritual connection to them, like they do more so in Eastern thought, then, you know, maybe we'd be a bit better off when it comes to taking care of the environment. But yeah, I've always really admired that about the nature spirits and how they're interacted with in Asia.
Yeah, and I think the closest we see to that here might be Hawaii. Like, I see a lot of that tradition and perspective in Hawaii as well.
Yeah, well, maybe it is kind of like a Christian idea with, you know, one of the main concepts being, like, man has dominion over nature. So there's less responsibility in a way to take care of it than there might be in some of the older traditions where it's very much seen as like an interaction between you and nature that has to be within balance. I don't know, Dan, did you have any thought of that as the resident Catholic?
Well, if you're a Christian or a Catholic, everything is demons. So you're not allowed to play with anything.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, Benabel, like, Can you explain a little bit more, just like the practical everyday stuff? Like, do you have an altar? What is your current practice sort of look and feel like?
And so, in Taoist traditions, yes, people would have an altar. And I think a lot of the esoteric practitioners have a really huge, fancy one. You know, it's, you know, more is more. For me, I was more interested in house hunting and finding a home in space that the land itself and then the property itself and then the feng shui, everything itself was arranged or was in, create an energy or create a grid in such a way that it itself, to me, would have felt sacred. And so for me, I was looking for a home that felt like an altar. And so because that was my approach to where I wanted to live, my whole house is my altar. But I don't know if that's a tradition specific thing or that's just me personally. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have like one designated spot. I have like various statues and talismans kind of just scattered throughout my apartment. But that's fascinating that you took that approach to finding a house. And I can only imagine how, like, that's like an extra layer of stress that must have been. Like, not only are you trying to find a house, you have to also, like, find a house that fits with a good sense of, like, chi energy. Was that tricky, trying to find a place?
I spent so we were ready to move into our first home for, I think, 5 years, but we just kept holding off. So I was searching for 5 years, and I knew exactly what I was looking for, and I would try to, I mean, I knew the location, I knew kind of, you know, the sort of spacing of mountains and hills and valleys and closeness to water bodies. So yeah, it took me 5 years to find the house that we live in now.
Where are you at right now?
Or what state are you in?
Castro Valley. Oh, California.
California.
Castro Valley. Is that Northern California?
Yeah, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, which actually, like, there's a lot of places here that has bad feng shui, so it was really, really hard. A layer there, too, because there were a lot of the nicer, like, for example, Piedmont is considered one of the nicer neighborhoods in the Oakland East Bay Area, but I didn't like the feng shui there, so it was really hard to find someplace where I liked the feng shui but was still close to work, you know?
Yeah, like, as a real estate, as your local Chicago real estate professional right here, I'm really curious, like, what was the criteria? Like, how exactly did you narrow it down in your house hunt? Was it, like, just a vibe or an intuition, or were they really specific criteria?
So what's interesting is I studied real estate as well, just out of personal curiosity. And I was going to take the broker's license just because at that point I was like, why not? I didn't end up taking it because I was too busy, but that was where I was headed because I was house hunting for so long, right? A lot of the principles that you learn, it's been too many years, I can't remember, but you know how like certain real estate have higher market value or how do you ascertain the marketability of a home that you learn in real estate? Those are feng shui principles. Feng shui principles are exact to that. They mirror that. So, for example, one of them was a commercial. You want the windows, I think it was on the west or something like that. Like, those are very similar because of how the sun rises and the sun sets. And there are all of these sort of market factors and indicators you learn in real estate is exactly the same principles you find in feng shui. And so, yeah, I was looking for certain factors. Like, I wanted the back of the home to be facing north and the front of the home to be facing south. I wanted the street to be a particular way. I didn't want a corner property. I know sometimes, you know how corner parcels have lower market values. And so in feng shui, they also say that houses at intersections are not that great in terms of homes at intersections. And then there's an interesting correlation in real estate as well, where homes at intersections tend to have lower real estate value.
I've even heard, I don't even know where I heard it, but I've heard that cul-de-sacs, the energy on a cul-de-sac is actually like kind of stagnant because it like just stops at the end and has to like reverse its way out. I actually grew up on a cul-de-sac, but yes. That made me think of cul-de-sacs too.
Yeah. I would say it's more, yes, that's generally true, but it also depends on, like, are there a lot of trees or is there anything in the area that helps kind of stimulate the energy that might otherwise become stagnant there? So it's true that a cul-de-sac in and of itself would create stagnant energy, and that can make it more stale and harder for people there to be more successful or people to sort of be more ambitious. But then if there are certain landmarks or things that you do to sort of energize the energy there, the chi there, then that's not true anymore. So there's many, many factors, but yes, you're correct.
You know, this really makes me think that there's a market out there for real estate agents specifically that are knowledgeable on feng shui and then can, like, help people through that process, especially in probably the area you're in. I feel like there would be a lot of people who would seek out a realtor with that knowledge.
Yeah, I think so.
That's so fascinating. So it sounds like you finally found the place, though.
Yeah. I also, when I talk about feng shui, I always talk about not looking for perfect feng shui. So it's not so much that this place is flawless in terms of its energy, but it's perfectly compatible to me. And I think that's another very important thing to stress. When you look at very general rules, like, you know, it's like all purpose, you know, like even when you look at clothing, the things that say fits everybody, it never really does. You still want something that is more haute couture. And so I think that that's the same thing when it comes to feng shui. It has to be tailor-made to you. And that's also why feng shui masters care so much about astrology, because they need to know your birth chart and all the birth charts of the people who will be living in that house so that they can make sure it's tailor-made to you and not just a generic sense of good feng shui.
And so if somebody was casting charts to, you know, lay out a house through feng shui, would they cast a Western astrological chart or are there Eastern charts?
Yeah, well, the traditional would, of course, be the Eastern forms of chart, bazi, or another form of Chinese astrology. But because I studied both, I find that there's so much similarity between the two that you can, as long as you're following some sort of a scientific system within that astrology, you can absolutely use Western astrology. So, for example, I personally use Hellenistic astrology. I like to work with whole signs because the whole signs approach is a little bit more similar to Eastern astrological principles than Placidus or Coach. And so that's what I work with. So I actually only use Western astrology. And that also helps me have a common vocabulary or more of a common vocabulary with people here in the West when I'm talking about them.
Yeah, I use whole sign houses too. And I'm sort of a student of Chris Brennan with the astrology podcast, and sort of like it's crazy how popular Hellenistic astrology has gotten, but it's really what took astrology out of like the cookbook, like 70s, like what's your sun sign, like culture, into like this is written by like a Stoic from like the Hellenistic era. Like it seems so much more legit all of a sudden.
Yeah, for sure.
So with your current practice, you kind of talked about how, you know, you lay out your house and stuff. What does your spirit communication look like? Or could you, if you have like a relationship or a practice to like have a working relationship with any spirits, like how do you maintain that?
Let's see. Well, I have an orchard, so I grow a lot of fruit trees and a lot of, I have a garden as well. And so how I approach gardening, for example, is going to be from a place of seeing them as more alive, I think, and having more of a personality than most people would approach, you know, horticulture, you know, their gardening. And so I think that kind of governs how I approach, you know, my trees, just for one instance. This is not necessarily spirit contact, but, you know, in terms of cooking and diet, it's completely, you know, by consultation of traditional Chinese medicine and understanding that there are not just sort of the medical, you know, the holistic medicine aspect to it, but also a metaphysical, you know, certain types of food like sesame seeds, just for one example, or cinnamon. There are certain herbs and seasons that correspond with the prosperity that you're going to want be more intentional about in terms of incorporating into your everyday diet and how you cook and prepare food. And if, you know, this dish has, you know, ingredients that are more keyed to prosperity, then while I'm preparing the ingredients and chopping up the vegetables and cooking it, my intentions are very much keyed, and even the mantras I'm reciting are very much toward blessing the food, so whoever eats it will be blessed with prosperity. And if something else is more about physical health, then that's what I'm going to be thinking about while I'm actually cooking the dish. So those are ways that you know, my spiritual beliefs are integrated and folded into everyday life. In terms of spirit contacts, I don't go out of my way looking for that, and I don't go, you know, like have that on a regular basis. If that's more, for me, it's more reactive. I have a more of a reactive relationship. If it happens, then, you know, you meet that where it is, but I don't go out looking for that.
Nice. Yeah. I have a tendency to try to like go out and look for it sometimes.
And also for our listeners, as we're wrapping up here, you have a website where they can find more about you and as well as your YouTube channel. Is that correct?
That's right.
And what is your website and what's your YouTube channel under?
It's Benebel Wen, BenebelWen.com. And then if you just search in the key bar Benebel Wen on YouTube, you'll pull me up.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I really enjoyed chatting with you today, and I feel like we barely scratched the surface on some of this stuff. There is so much depth to a lot of what we talked about, and I'm excited. I'm going to definitely get your Tao of Craft book next as soon as I finish Holistic Tarot, because I'm still a newbie when it comes to stuff like that, and I can't wait to learn more.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I didn't know we were going to get to talk about all this fun stuff. I thought it was going to be very tarot-centric, and I feel like we could keep going for a while, but it was great talking with you, Benebel, and hopefully we can talk again and continue to learn more about this awesome tradition of yours.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, I thought we were going to talk tarot as well, but, you know, it's all good. Wonderful.
Well, thanks again for coming on with us today, and we will talk to you later.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks so much, guys, for listening to our interview with author Benebel Wen. We weren't really planning on having the conversation go in the direction it did, but we're super happy that it did go that way. So thanks to Benebel for being a guest on our show.
And of course, we want to thank our patrons. So a big resounding thank you to Andy, Danielle, Patsy, and Philip, and also Willie. So thank you so much for supporting us. And for anyone new, definitely check out our Patreon. We rely on you guys to keep this show going. So, yeah.
We should have a website probably within a month, and that's going to be the beginning of lots of new ventures and stuff like that. So,
yeah, speaking of the card of the week and planning.
Yeah, we need to get on that, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, also, guys, don't forget to leave us a nice little review on iTunes. We seriously appreciate that. And share the show with any friends that you think might be, if they're not into the woo, if they're not into the occult, maybe they're curious about it and maybe we can help them.
Everyone's a little bit occult curious.
Yeah, some of us are have an unquenchable thirst.
Well, thanks again so much for listening today, and we'll see you next week.
See you guys.